So sacituzumab govitecan was just added to the NCCN guidelines as a category one preferred first-line treatment option for metastatic TNBC. And this designation applies regardless of PD-L1 status in patients with no germline BRCA 1 or 2 pathogenic variant. Ooh, it's a mouthful. Can you walk us through what that designation actually means in terms of the strength of the evidence and why this update is so significant?
Of course. So in general, category one just means there's high level evidence, such as a phase three randomized trial. In addition to the level of evidence, it also means that there was uniform NCCN consensus, which they define as at least 85% support from the panel. So it's not always the easiest to get that category one recommendation from NCCN. So this is a very exciting update for sure. And particularly important because it really dramatically shifts the treatment paradigm in the metastatic triple negative space away from traditional chemotherapy to antibody drug conjugates in the first line setting, which I think is really exciting for patients and providers.
Yeah, absolutely. What does this shift mean for how we think about biomarker testing upfront, specifically for that PD-L1 status and whether that still matters in this treatment landscape? And how should clinicians interpret those results when they're making these treatment decisions?
Yeah, that's a really important point to consider. I think in all of breast cancer, biomarker testing is extremely important. In this specific setting, in the metastatic triple negative breast cancer space, there hasn't been much of a change to practice with this update as far as what biomarkers we are getting, because previously both BRCA mutations as well as PD-L1 status sort of dictated first-line treatment decisions. And that's still the case here. Even though the cytotoxic agent that's being chosen, whether that be with or without pembrolizumab, may change from chemotherapy to an antibody drug conjugate, the biomarkers haven't really changed in the information that we need to be able to make those first line decisions.
Perfect, that makes sense. The guideline update hinges on biomarker-driven decision making. So, how does this change the upfront biomarker testing conversation, and what role do pharmacists play in making sure that the right tests are ordered before the treatment is selected?
Absolutely. I really think that pharmacists have an integral role in ensuring that the necessary biomarker testing is not only occurring, but also occurring as quickly as possible. So, in this setting, with metastatic triple negative breast cancer, we really want to make sure that our initiation of treatment is as timely as possible. And so, really, as soon as metastatic disease is even a concern, whether it's even back on final pathology, the discussion, conversation about biomarker testing, what needs tested, how we're going to send it, should be immediately started. And so, I think because pharmacists are so integrated into the clinics, it's a really important and essential role for us to play in making sure that that timeliness can occur. I know there's all sorts of background complicating factors like insurance and authorizations and those sorts of things, but at least making sure those discussions around what sort of biomarkers do we need to have done and how quickly can we start that process really needs to happen as soon as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. What does guideline concordant care look like in practice for this patient population? And walk us through the clinical decision tree that a pharmacist is using and where you see the common gaps between the guidelines and what actually happens.
Yeah, so for me, the decision tree really starts with the germline BRCA testing. So frequently, patients have already had this done. So it's in the guidelines for early stage triple negative patients to receive this testing. So if you have a patient that is a recurrence from an early stage triple negative breast cancer, a lot of times they will have already had this testing done. So that's usually the first place I start. There is obviously the scenario where they're de novo metastatic and this is all new and we still have to get that testing, but that's usually the place that I start. is have they already had this testing done and what is the result? If a patient does have a germline BRCA mutation, we can kind of start the process of initiating a PARP inhibitor without really having to wait for PD-L1 status. But that's of course not the majority of patients. So for people that are BRCA wild type, next it is determining that PD-L1 status. And so that does have a little bit of a delay and waiting for those results to come back. And then once those results are available, if they are BRCA wild type and PD-L1 negative, then we can start the process for sacituzumab govitecan as a single agent. As opposed to if they're BRCA wild type and PD-L1 positive, then we would want to initiate sacituzumab govitecan with pembrolizumab. Some of the gaps that I see arise in this area is somatic BRCA mutations. So that often occurs where every clinician may not do the exact same thing in that scenario. Some people may still treat with a PARP inhibitor first. But technically, what's in the guidelines is that germline BRCA is what's the category one, and then the somatic is an option in like certain circumstances in category two. So that may not always be the same from provider to provider and what decision they make there. And then additionally, when to start the sacituzumab govitecan can vary from providers as well. So for example, now that the sacituzumab govitecan is category one preferred regardless of PD-L1 status, do you go ahead and get that agent started and then add in the pembrolizumab when that PD-L1 result comes back if they are PD-L1 positive? Or is the thought more of you really want to make sure you're starting that immunotherapy when their disease burden is the highest? And so even if they were to come back PD-L1 positive, you would ideally have wanted to start it all at the same time, as opposed to starting the sacituzumab first. That's typically my preference. But I, like we kind of talked about delays in this very aggressive setting are problematic. And so that it may not always be the same in every patient scenario or every provider case as to what they're electing to do in that scenario, because there can be a little bit of a delay in getting some of those biomarkers back.
Sure. In your own experience, have you seen guideline concordant care actually being implemented since this update? And what barriers have you encountered, and what have you done to kind of overcome those?
I think, at least in my experience, the guideline concordant care has been implemented pretty quickly and easily. I think the biggest challenge is that delay in waiting for those PD-L1 results to come back. That's not necessarily specific to the recent update. That was the same before too. But it definitely is one of the challenges that we face in an ideal setting. My preference would be to be able to go ahead and put in a sacituzumab govitecan with pembrolizumab treatment plan into the patient's EMR, get all of the background steps of insurance approval done, and then as soon as the result comes back, say, go ahead with both agents, or know that PD-L1's negative, we're just going to pull off that pembrolizumab and go forward with just the single agent. But unfortunately, insurances don't really like that. They want that PD-L1 result to be back before they approve any component. And so then what ends up happening is you have to wait for the result, then you put in the treatment plan, then you have to wait for the insurance to approve it. So it's like two delays. So I think just the kind of logistics of getting treatment started quickly in this patient population where you really don't want to have delays in treatment initiation is probably the biggest challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. We're now seeing really important data from ASCENT-03 and ASCENT-04 in advanced or metastatic triple-negative breast cancer, particularly with efficacy signals and comparative performance against the current standards. So, from your perspective, what are the most clinically meaningful findings from these trials, and how might these results shift the sequencing or address therapeutic gaps in this population?
I think, of course, the obvious excitement is the significant improvement in progression-free survival. Historically, this has not been a patient population who really have had a lot of very effective lines of therapy. So the longer we can stay on that first-line therapy, the better, of course. But I think in addition to that aspect, which is obviously very exciting. Something else that I think is important is the duration of response. So there was a very significant improvement in duration of response for those people that did have an initial response to sacituzumab govitecan. So instead of the difference in progression-free survival being like 3, 3.5 months in ASCENT-03 and 04, it's like 5 and 7 months different in duration of response. And anecdotally, that's what you see in clinical practice too. The people that do respond to sacituzumab govitecan have a very long response. And so for me, that's the most exciting part, right? Like obviously I want everybody to respond to the treatment, but I think it's really exciting for those patients that do respond. They're responding for a really long time, right? Like they're on their first line treatment for over a year in those trials. And so that's a dramatic shift from what we have seen previously. I've been working in the breast oncology space a little over 10 years now. And so that definitely was not always the results that we were seeing in the first line space. So that's a really exciting part of these trials that I don't want to not recognize. The other thing that I think is outside of efficacy, the tolerability, so the side effects that you see are very different with antibody drug conjugates as opposed to traditional chemotherapy. And so that's another important distinction to make with this data. Commonly, and with traditional chemotherapy, patients would receive indefinite taxanes as their chemotherapy that was used in the metastatic triple-negative breast cancer space, which is almost certainly going to cause dose-limiting peripheral neuropathy. And so, not to say that sacituzumab govitecan doesn't have side effects, it definitely does, but they are sometimes a little bit more able to be prevented and easier to manage than peripheral neuropathy, which can be very impactful for a patient's quality of life. And so I think that is something that is important to recognize as well. There's always going to be gaps. So I don't think we can really talk about any new antibody drug conjugate data without pointing out the gap in knowledge of sequencing these therapies. And that's still true here, right? Like we don't know what the efficacy of a second line antibody drug conjugate is going to be after sacituzumab govitecan in the first line, as far as how effective is it in comparison to how it was studied in the trial, or even how effective is it in comparison to our other options like single agent chemotherapy? That's all kind of a data free zone. There's lots of centers looking at that in their own patients, but there's not any, kind of like large randomized trials that are available to kind of tell us what that looks like in this space. So that's definitely still a large gap in our treatment knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see. This guideline update created a meaningful shift in how TNBC is treated in the first line setting. So how do you think this update should reshape the way oncology pharmacists are approaching shared decision making with patients around their options, particularly when they're balancing efficacy, toxicity, broader considerations like quality of life and patient preferences and their individual goals?
I honestly find this change in practice to be pretty meaningful in a lot of ways for patients. So, as I mentioned, typically their first line treatment prior to this often was a taxane that frequently is given on a weekly basis. So, even though the visits aren't that much less with sacituzumab govitecan, it's a little bit less with the day one, day eight, every 21-day schedule. They at least get that third week off. So it's a little bit less frequent of visits for them, which can be very important for some people, especially if they're still working and they're having to take time off of work to come to their appointments. And then, as we kind of briefly discussed already, the side effect profile with sacituzumab Govitecan, it definitely has a very high probability of causing neutropenia as well as diarrhea. But I do find these toxicities a little bit easier to prevent and manage than, like we talked about with peripheral neuropathy, where there's not any like hugely effective prevention strategies. So, for example, at our institution, we use primary prophylactic G-CSF in almost all of our sacituzumab govitecan patients, which really I think makes a big difference in the rates, in the incidence of neutropenia that you see from sacituzumab. And then typically we're able to pretty easily like prevent and manage the diarrhea. And so from a patient perspective, that can be very impactful. I do think there are probably additional things to consider, right? Like we want to make sure that if they are experiencing diarrhea, even if it is quote unquote mild, it's not impacting their ability to do the things that they want to do. And so, whether that means scheduling their treatments on different days so that it doesn't impact with their regular schedule, I think those are important conversations to have with patients. And then I think probably one other aspect that's specific to sacituzumab govitecan that's really important to have as a discussion with the patient is around pharmacogenomics. So a lot of institutions are using like commercial NGS tests to identify the biomarkers that are important to know in the breast cancer space. And a lot of these companies have started incorporating pharmacogenomics. And so we have this information kind of available at our fingertips. And so we know what someone's UGT1A1 status is. Now, there aren't any particular recommendations at this point if someone is a poor metabolizer to give them a lower dose of sacituzumab govitecan. But we do have data showing that they are more likely to experience side effects if they are. So I think that's a really good place to kind of have that conversation with the patient and say, these are the two options. You know, we could start at full dose and see how you tolerate and go down if you have side effects. Alternatively, we could do a preemptive dose reduction and increase if you do well, and let the patient kind of make that decision. I think would be like a very reasonable and important aspect of that shared decision making.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Sort of a follow-up to that question, how do you ensure the patient's voice is meaningfully incorporated alongside the clinical data?
Yeah, I think that's a really essential role for pharmacists. I find commonly that patients are a little bit more comfortable with their clinical pharmacist when it is a conversation regarding dose reductions than they sometimes are with their treating oncologist. And I can understand that fear and hesitation, absolutely. And so sometimes their concerns may only be communicated to us, even though they've also seen their treating provider that day. And so I do think that's a really important role for us to play, is not just making sure that all of their concerns are heard, but also being part of that decision making as well. And what are our options? What sort of things can we try, and how does that work best for the patient without impacting outcomes?
Absolutely. Amazing. Is there anything you want to add? Anything that I didn't think to ask about?
I think the only thing that I didn't mention that I think is still like a hot topic or something that we're not really sure what we're going to do with at this point is the datopotamab deruxtecan data. So it's been presented, but it's not fully published yet. And so at this point isn't included in the guidelines, but we kind of know it's coming and are not 100% sure with where that's going to go, right? So the trial design for the TROPION-Breast02 was a little bit different than ASCENT-04. They didn't have doublet chemotherapy in the control arm. They didn't permit crossover. But it is looking like there is going to be an overall survival advantage. So I think it'll be really interesting to see how guidelines categorize those two different antibody drug conjugates in the next guideline update, and then what that looks like, not just from a clinician standpoint and all the questions that we have, knowing that the trials were done differently and that makes interpreting the results very challenging, but also, of course, like the side effect profile, the considerations for the patient, things that we discussed. With sacituzumab are going to be an even larger role, probably in the near future. So it's a really exciting time in the metastatic triple-negative breast cancer space. So I'm excited to see all this new data being incorporated into clinical practice.
Yeah, absolutely. In a space that needed all of this data too, so that's always wonderful.
Absolutely.